pull up a chair. I want to put you in a cockpit on a September morning in 1929. Long Island, Mitchell Field. There's a biplane sitting on the grass, a Consolidated NY-2, a fat little trainer with a big radial engine up front and two open cockpits. And there's a man climbing into the back seat who is about to do something that every pilot before him would have called impossible, or maybe just plain suicidal. He's going to take off, fly a full circuit, and land, and he's going to do the whole thing without ever once looking outside the airplane. The rear cockpit has a canvas hood pulled over it. He can't see the sky, he can't see the ground, he can't see the horizon. All he can see is a panel of instruments, some of which had barely been invented yet. This is Radio Hangar, I'm Tail Dragger, and this is the hangar. Today we're going to talk about the flight that dragged aviation out of the age of the seat of your pants and into the age of instruments, the blind flight of Jimmy Doolittle. Now before I get rolling, let me tell you today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight, first solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. And I'll tell you what, the instrument rating coin is one you earn with your whole body, because learning to trust the panel over your own inner ear is one of the hardest things a pilot ever does. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at aviationsoul.com. All right, let's set the scene properly. Back when Avigis was cheap and airspace was free, flying was a fair weather affair. And I don't mean that as a figure of speech, I mean it literally. If the weather was bad, you did not fly, full stop. Here's the problem, and it's a problem that killed an enormous number of good pilots in the 1920s. When you fly into a cloud or into fog or into a moonless haze over dark country, you lose the horizon. And the moment you lose the horizon, your body starts lying to you. Your inner ear, that little set of fluid-filled canals that keeps you upright when you're walking around on the ground, is a wonderful instrument for standing on the earth and a catastrophic instrument for flying an airplane. It cannot tell the difference between a gentle bank and straight and level flight. Sit in a slow turn long enough, and the fluid settles, and your body swears to you that you're flying wings level. Then you roll out and your body screams that you're banking the other way. So you correct, into a turn, and now you're in what we call the graveyard spiral. The airplane winds up tighter and tighter, the nose drops, the airspeed builds, and the pilot, absolutely certain he's flying straight, pulls back on the stick, and pulling back in a bank just tightens the spiral. The airplane comes out of the bottom of the cloud in pieces, or it comes out in one piece going straight down. And either way, the result is a smoking hole and a funeral. They had a name for it back then. They called it flying into the soup. And the soup won more often than not. Now here's where it gets interesting. There was a foundation, the Daniel Guggenheim Fund for the Promotion of Aeronautics. And they decided somebody ought to solve this. Not with bravery. Bravery was killing people, they wanted to solve it with engineering. They set up what they called the Full Flight Laboratory, and to run the flying end of it, they went and got a young Army lieutenant who had already made himself famous as a racing pilot and a stuntman, James Harold Doolittle. Jimmy, a little bantam rooster of a man, boxer's build, quick as a cat, and smart. People forget how smart. This wasn't just a daredevil. Doolittle had a doctorate in aeronautical engineering from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, one of the first ever awarded. So when Doolittle looked at the problem of flying blind, he didn't look at it like a stunt. He looked at it like a laboratory experiment. And the experiment came down to a simple, brutal question. If your body can't be trusted in the clouds, what can be? The answer had to be instruments. But the instruments they had in 1929 were not up to the job. Think about what a pilot had on the panel back then. You had an airspeed indicator, you had an altimeter, but it was coarse, it drifted, and it wasn't sensitive enough to catch a slow climb or descent until you'd already gone hundreds of feet. You had a magnetic compass, and if you've ever flown behind a whiskey compass, you know it swings and lurches and lags and turns itself into a liar every time you bank. And you had a turn indicator, a crude one. What you did not have was a way to see the horizon when the horizon was gone. And you did not have a precise way to know your altitude in the moment. So Doolittle went and found the men who could build what he needed. And this is the part I love, because it's a story about a pilot and instrument makers working shoulder to shoulder. He went to Elmer Sperry Jr. and the Sperry Gyroscope Company. The Sperrys understood the gyroscope, that spinning wheel that wants to stay pointed where it's pointed, no matter how you tumble the frame around it. And out of that partnership came two instruments that are sitting on the panel of nearly every airplane flying today. The first was the artificial horizon, the attitude indicator, a little gyro-stabilized line that shows you the airplane's wings against a fixed horizon bar, so that when the real horizon is swallowed by cloud, you've got a horizon painted right there on your panel. Bank the airplane, and the little wings tilt. Pitch up, and the dot climbs above the line. For the first time, a pilot could see his attitude without seeing the sky. The second was the directional gyro, the heading indicator, a compass that didn't swing and lurch because it wasn't magnetic. It was a gyro that held steady, and you set it against the mag compass in steady flight, and then it just sat there and told you the truth through every turn. And there was a third piece, and this one gets overlooked. A fellow named Paul Colesman, a German immigrant, built a barometric altimeter so precise, so finely geared, that it could show a pilot his altitude down to within a few feet. The story goes he ground the gears using jeweler's tools meant for fine watches. That sensitive altimeter meant that on final approach a pilot could know, really know, how high he was above the ground when he could not see the ground at all. We still call the little knob that sets the barometric pressure the Colesman window. Every one of you who's ever set 2992 before an instrument approach has said that man's name without knowing it. So now Doolittle had the tools, an artificial horizon to keep the wings level, a directional gyro to hold heading, a sensitive Colesman altimeter to nail his altitude, and on the ground, a radio system, a pair of radio beacons that let him fly a course and know when he was crossing the field. But here's the thing about tools. Having them and trusting them are two entirely different animals, and this is the human heart of the story. So let me slow down here. Doolittle spent months under that hood practicing, and he had a safety pilot up front, another army flyer named Ben Kelsey, who sat in the open cockpit with his hands ready near the controls in case the whole thing went pear-shaped. Doolittle in the back, hood over his head, flying by the panel. Kelsey up front, looking at the real world, ready to grab it. And Doolittle described what that was like, learning to fly with his eyes instead of his gut. He'd be flying along. Panel says, wings level, everything's fine. And his whole body would be shrieking at him that he was in a diving turn to the left. Every instinct, every nerve ending, every year of flying experience telling him the instruments are wrong. Save yourself, roll right, pull up. And he had to sit there and do nothing. He had to override 30 years of a human body's survival wiring and believe a little gyroscope spinning in a brass case. That is not a mechanical skill. That is a spiritual discipline. Anybody who's earned an instrument rating knows exactly the fight I'm describing. It's the hardest lesson in all of flying. Believe the panel. Believe the panel. Your body is a liar in the clouds. And the panel is the only thing in that cockpit telling you the truth. Now, as it happened on the actual demonstration morning, September 24, 1929, there wasn't any real fog, weather was decent, and Doolittle wanted this to count. He wanted it to be honest, so he had them pull that canvas hood clear over his cockpit, so he genuinely could not see a thing outside, sealed himself in a little canvas cave with nothing but the glow of the instruments. Ben Kelsey climbed in front with his hands held up in plain view, so everybody watching would know he wasn't touching a thing. And Jimmy Doolittle pushed the throttle up. Picture it. He can't see the runway. He holds the heading on the directional gyro, keeps the wings level on the artificial horizon, feels the tail come up, feels the wheels get light, and the little NY2 lifts off the grass at Mitchell Field with a blind man at the controls. He climbs to 1,000 feet on the sensitive altimeter. He flies a wide circle out and around, following the radio beacons, and then he brings her back. And the landing, that's the one that gets me. Coming down out of the sky and putting an airplane back on the earth is the hardest thing to do without your eyes, because the ground is coming up at you and you cannot see it. He worked that sensitive Colesman altimeter down, foot by foot, held his heading, eased the nose up, and let her settle onto the grass. 10 miles or so, start to finish, wheels up and wheels down, and Jimmy Doolittle never saw the world outside that cockpit one single time. When they pulled the hood back, he'd done it. The first flight in history flown entirely, takeoff to landing, on instruments. Now, I want to be fair about something, because I'm an old pilot and I don't like it when people gild a story. That flight was a demonstration. Conditions were controlled. Kelsey was right there. It wasn't Doolittle stumbling into a thunderstorm and clawing his way out, but that's exactly what made it matter, because he proved in front of witnesses, in the cold light of a laboratory experiment, that an airplane could be flown safely without any outside reference at all. He took the thing that had been killing pilots for 2 decades, the soup, and he showed that the soup could be beaten, not with guts, with gauges, and think about what that unlocked. Everything you take for granted today comes downstream from that grass field. Airline schedules that run in weather. Instrument approaches that bring a jet full of people down through 1,000 feet of overcast to a runway they don't see until they're almost on it. The whole instrument flight rules system. Every pilot who ever shot an approach to minimums and broke out with the runway lights right where they were supposed to be owes a little tip of the hat to a bantam rooster and a canvas-hooded biplane in 1929. The artificial horizon, the directional gyro, the sensitive altimeter, those weren't just gadgets. They were the beginning of the idea that a pilot's most important sense in the clouds isn't feel, it's discipline. The discipline to look at the panel and believe it. I think about that every time I brief a young pilot working on the rating, sweating under a view-limiting device, fighting that same fight Doolittle fought, body screaming one thing and the panel saying another. I tell them, that feeling you're fighting right now, Jimmy Doolittle fought it first and he won, and the fact that you can win it too is the whole reason you can fly your family somewhere on a gray afternoon and get them home. And here's the part that ought to make you smile. Doolittle went on to a career that most men couldn't fit into three lifetimes. Racing champion, he led the raid on Tokyo in 1942, commanded a whole numbered air force in the war, won the Medal of Honor, and near the end of his life, when people asked him what he was proudest of, that quiet little blind flight over Long Island was always near the very top of the list. Not the fame, the engineering, the morning he proved you could fly without looking. For today's story, I leaned on the records of the Guggenheim Fund's Full Flight Laboratory, the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum, and Doolittle's own memoir, and I'm grateful to all of them for keeping the details straight. If you want the photographs of that funny little hooded NY2, come find us over at radiohangar.com. So the next time you set the Kalsman window before an approach, and that needle settles right where it ought to be, think of the watchmaker who ground those gears and the little pilot who bet his life that a spinning gyro tells the truth. It does, believe the panel. I'm Taildragger, keep the blue side up, even when you can't see which side is blue.